Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Katie Britton. Libba Bray's The Diviners took the world by storm, and readers of all ages have been eagerly awaiting the second novel, Lair of Dreams. Well, they no longer have to wait, and boy was it worth it. Set in the 1920s, it's a world of privilege and racism, glamour and immigrant ghettos, and people living in the shadows with special abilities. It is a great pleasure to welcome Libba Bray to the Roundtable.
Thank you so much, Katie. I'm pleased to be here. I always wanted to be a knight, so it's good to be here at the Roundtable.
Don't we all? I was very lucky. Well, lucky and saddened in a sense that I had not read The Diviners until I got Lair of Dreams, which it had always been on my nightstand, and I'm like, okay, I'll get to it. And then I hadn't. So I feel very lucky because I got to jump right into the second novel, and I did not have to wait.
You weren't one of the people cursing my name. Why is it taking you so long?
No, I was not one of them. But these are substantial books.
Well, yes, when you said that it was on your nightstand table, I was thinking, I hope that there are very strong legs on that table because they are not bite-sized books.
Okay, we're set in the Roaring Twenties. And the Diviners, they have these special powers, but they really haven't come out of the woodworks. They're kind of manifesting. People are keeping them a secret because it's shocking, especially if you're in the 20s. It's not extremely open-minded world out there.
I think it's interesting. One of the challenges, actually, in writing this story is because I think that when we have a narrative like this, you know, whether it's like Avengers Assemble, you think, okay, all these characters need to come together. But it's a very diverse cast, and they are separated by racial divides, by class divides, gender biases. I mean, you know, like there are so many things that work against their coming together that part of the story is how they overcome these obstacles to come together. And there are eight main characters, so trying to weave all of those storylines together. You know, I'm the sort of person, honestly, who I can't even write an organized grocery list. So it is a miracle that I leave the house wearing pants and holding my keys. So the idea that I'm trying to weave together eight different stories and do historical research at the same time is, please forgive me if I don't smell good. I try to shower when I can.
You are weaving these eight stories together. And what intrigued me was that as I'm getting towards the end of the first book, The Diviners, I'm realizing these people aren't going to meet yet. I loved that aspect of it, that you didn't just throw everything into the first novel and then take them on different explorations in the subsequent novels. So for you, was that hard to hold back a little bit, or did you really just want to take your time to let each character develop in their own way? I mean, we get a glimpse of Ling in the first novel, but then she plays a prominent part in the second one.
I'm of the slow burn varieties, you know, much to some people's chagrin. I kind of jokingly say that these are 19th century novels, but in a way they are. They take their time. They're big. There are a lot of different characters. And I think the other thing is, too, I was very much influenced not only by what I've read, but I'm also a huge TV fan. So serial TV like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, X-Files, Kolchak the Night Stalker, X-Files, I've jokingly called this X-Files with flappers. But I think, you know, the idea that you often have the big bad, whatever that is, but you've got these characters and you're only getting like, you're getting glimpses of them, and then knowing that this is a story that's going to stretch out over quite a few books, you know, I wanted to take my time and really have everybody get to know these characters. And there's a lot of story to explore. I mean, there's a government conspiracy. There's Project Buffalo that they're trying to explore. There is the seemingly malevolent figure called the Man in the Stovepipe Hat. He's also called the King of Crows. And they're trying to learn about this man. There are ghosts everywhere. Something is definitely happening around the margins. And so part of the fun of the series as well is developing New York City as a character, developing this, really diving into the 1920s in America, because I think that, you know, we're so used to the Roaring Twenties, and roar it did. I mean, you know, you've got jazz, you've got the Harlem Renaissance, you've got the Ziegfeld Follies, you've got speakeasies, and women have just gotten the vote, so you've got the flappers. I mean, it is a very sparkly period, but there's so much underneath that that is quite dark and scary. There's a lot about the eugenics movement and anti-immigration fervor. There's xenophobia, there's racism, there's the Ku Klux Klan. There's so much of that that's going on, and so much of that that has echoes that reach us today, where we are now.
And you really delve into that. In this novel, we're looking at the anti-immigration movement, and Ling has, the character has brought us into Chinatown, and there is a sleeping sickness that had started in Chinatown, then it moved over into the Jewish section of New York City and then the Polish. So everybody is very, very scared, and they have decided that they no longer want these immigrants in New York City.
Sounds kind of like the GOP.
I was listening to a Donald Trump story on NPR, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, Lair of Dreams, this is exactly what's happening. Build those walls and keep them out. And it's like that fervor that's happening again.
Well, and I think that, you know, when we do not pay attention to our history, we are often doomed to repeat it. We also, as artists, as writers, we don't create in a vacuum. And so as I was writing the series, there was so much that was happening, you know, everything from, you know, Ferguson to people like Donald Trump, who are building their platform on this, you know, this nativism, this anti-immigration fervor. And, you know, you just want to say, do we learn nothing? So I think it's important for people to pay attention and to look back and see what was wrought by the things that we have done in our past and, you know, hopefully not repeat them.
I feel that the beauty of these novels are that you tackle everything and you have everything in there. You're not just dealing with racism. You're not just dealing with anti-immigrants, or you're not just dealing with anti-gay, because you have a gay character who has dealt with the persecution from his family, and he has to keep it hidden because it's still frowned upon, even in New York City. And then having a black man, Memphis, dating a white woman, Theta, and everybody's frowning at them as well as their friends. And as we talked about the anti-immigration issue, I mean, you have tackled it, all these multifacets of life.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate it. It's important to me, and this is something I'm interested in. And I very much wanted to sort of explore American identity. And of course, we are not just one culture. We are made up of all kinds of cultures. And so being able to explore America and explore my own feelings about it, my own questions and doubts about American identity, when I think about the expansiveness of something like Walt Whitman's Crossing Brooklyn Ferry and how glorious that is, but then we also think about sort of the scars of our history, slavery, the Trail of Tears, this sort of xenophobia, especially what was happening at the turn of the last century, and which leads right into the 1920s, and which is still with us today. Those are things that interest me. And I grew up in a family where we discussed politics always. And so that's just interesting to me, in addition to like ghosts and things that go bump in the night and, you know, superhero kinds of stories. Those things are interesting to me.
Even if you're not interested in one thing, there are so many other beautiful aspects of these novels that we are interested in. And I mean, you talk about things that go bump in the night and creepy crawlies. I feel like these are the most un-ghost story ghost stories.
I would like a strawberry soda, but hold the strawberry. Just a whiff, just an essence.
Well,
that's a great quote.
I love to read ghost stories about different places in the Hudson Valley. I mean, we are ripe with wonderful history. And I would read those books and, you know, the woman with the veil standing on the steps just looking down, and they have a picture of her and reading that, and it makes your skin crawl. But I feel like that's what kind of deep-seated, you're looking at the history of why it happened to that person. You're looking at what life was like around them. And these books transport you to a completely different time and place out of the time and place that our characters are currently living in.
Well, thank you. I also love ghost stories. And in fact, I had a great-grandmother who lived to be 98. She was great. And she was deeply superstitious and deeply religious. But she loved ghost stories, and she used to tell them to me. But what was interesting was that she had been raised by her grandmother, and her grandmother was supposedly a psychic. So my great-grandmother would tell me these stories, and you know, they were always like kind of terrifying, and I loved them. But she told me this story about how she was sitting on the front porch with her grandmother, and her grandmother was rocking, and it was the middle of the day. Now, they owned the town funeral parlor, and it was right next door. And all of a sudden, her grandmother stops rocking and goes into one of her trances and says, "Someone has died. I see a short piece of string. It's a child. A child has died." You know, because they would measure the body with string and then come in and have the coffin made. And of course, she said, "I see a light on in the shop. It's a child. A child has died." And of course, my great-grandmother's freaked out by this because, of course, you know, they're just sitting there in the middle of the day and there's no one. And that night, my great-grandmother woke up and her room overlooked the shop and there was a light on in the shop. And she went down there to see what was going on, and someone had come from a neighboring town and they had brought a short piece of string to have a coffin made because a child had died. And so she would tell me these stories, and then it would be like, "Okay, sweetheart, go on up to the attic. No, we'll let you out in the morning." You know. So I just want to say I come by the creepy honestly. This is the damage of my youth, and I'm working it through.
Do you incorporate any of those things into your writing then?
I do think that sense of just, I mean, obviously somebody who was psychic, who had this sort of ability to see something else, whatever that may be, you know, certainly I wasn't around to witness it firsthand, but the idea that somebody could seem to have this this ability is there, and that ability is something that is not, you know, it's not really tangible. So that to me, I think, does make its way into the stories. But one of the things that I really wanted to do with all of the ghosts in this series was kind of to focus on what felt like very American ghost stories. I mean, you think about like The Devil and Daniel Webster, and, you know, I think about Nathaniel Hawthorne just in general. You know, I wanted to have that sort of American ghost story feel. So that has been something that has been really fun to play with and does kind of bring me back to those stories that my great-grandmother told me, because she grew up in Pennsylvania in the late 1800s. So I was fortunate enough, and I was also fortunate enough to have my own grandmother's diary from 1927, though it has nothing to do with ghosts. I think just the idea of, in a way, those family members are ghosts. I mean, there's a lot about ancestors in this book, and I think that their stories live on, and I think that we are our stories. So in that way, yes, they're very present.
So with all of these family stories that you have and the history that everybody has, you've done a significant amount of historical research for these novels. How do you find time to write?
Well, there is a reason that it took 3 years for book two to come out. I always feel, you know, and I guess part of that is because there's so many things I'm researching. It's not just one thing. So I always feel like, oh, I could do more research. I could do more research. I wish I had time to do more research because, I mean, there's so many interesting things. But it's also, I think, there's, you know, like, okay, I'm researching certain aspects and I'm getting an overview of some things. But, you know, I think, oh, wow, wouldn't it be great to be able to write a whole book about X and just spend your time researching X? But I don't get to do that. I have to be sort of a dilettante. But, yeah, I mean, you know, it's the nature of the beast. It does take a lot of work. I love doing the research. I find it fascinating. And then I can be that obnoxious person at parties who, you know, will come in and say, did you know that actually there was a thriving gay scene in New York City in the 1920s? And everyone looks at you like, okay.
Thanks,
you know,
for the memo.
The Cheese Whiz. What else did you want to say? Did you know that windshield wipers were sometimes vacuum powered? That's fascinating, really. I'll just have another drink.
Were they really?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, well, that was actually one of the things that I had to look up one day. I was writing a scene in which someone was driving down the street and it began to rain. And I said that they turned on the windshield wipers. And I had to stop because I thought, did they have windshield wipers? I don't know. How did those work? So then I had to go down the rabbit hole of trying to find out the answer to that. And I think I ended up cutting the scene. And that happens a lot of times, too. I wrote for book two, I ended up writing over 300,000 words. And I cut not half of them, but close. And I think that that's also part of the insane process that, oh, God, why is this my process? I'm so envious of people who are really organized and linear in their thinking. It should be quite painfully apparent by this interview that I'm not linear in my thinking, that it's a complete ADD kind of mishmash. And that's really the way that I write, too, that I feel like the story sort of emerges over writing and rewriting and rewriting. And so it takes a lot of time. When it's a 700-page book with 8 main characters and historical research, it's not going to be a book a year unless I develop that superpower. And if anyone out there knows how I can develop that superpower, please contact Katie at the station.
I shall pass it on. It is well worth the wait because these...
Well, thank you.
These books are amazing. The name of the book is Lair of Dreams. It is the second in the Diviners series. Libba, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been such a pleasure.
Oh my gosh, it was a pleasure for me. Thank you so much, Katie.
Again, the name of Libba Bray's novel is Lair of Dreams. It is the second in the Diviners series and published by Little Brown. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. You're my kill of the night.